Stations, ladies and gentlemen. Hello again, this is Walter O'Keefe, welcoming you to another 2 hours of the show we know as Almanac. A bit of reminiscence, a bit of wisdom, an interview with somebody, and a harking back to the years when the world was gentler and the world was younger than it is now. We're going to put a little bit of stress today on 1947, and there were two big things in sports that year that have shaken... Well, anyway, let me put it this way. Jackie Robinson was, for the first time, admitted to Major League Baseball. He was the first gentleman who was colored who became such a big star. Look at the effect Jackie Robinson had on his times and his people. The other big story that I like to read, especially in the light of recent events in football, Notre Dame were the national champions that year. Notre Dame were the champions. They were coached by Frank Leahy, who was coached by Cal Milner, his nephew. Anyway, we've got a guest today. His name is Alan Young. Alan came from Canada after he came from Scotland, and this is a very important guy. And Alan illustrates something I read this week. It's a very important line, and the line is simple and straight and true. And the line is this: character is more important than talent. And when you think it over, character is more important than talent. You know an awful lot of talented people who are fiends and monsters and throw their weight around and take it on people and charge it up and say, well, look, I'm a genius, I'm talented. And then they use other language that we can't use in radio. So this guy has a lot of character, and what's important, he's got a lot of talent, too. And he isn't one of those people who's been carried away by celebrityhood. So many people, a guy gets up there in the billing and up in the dough and up there, and he gets so busy being a celebrity, he forgets how to be a human being. That isn't true about Alan Young. Alan Young is a very warm human being. You're going to enjoy him as I do and as I did. And you'll be back here to meet Alan Young in just a moment. This is Walter O'Keefe, ladies and gentlemen. And in my hand, I was just handed a can. It says, this is the smog used by famous Hollywood stars, made in Los Angeles by angels to ensure freshness and purity. Keep the container tightly sealed. Beware of imitations. Accept none but pure Los Angeles smog. Genuine. And there's a picture of the city hall and some peasants from... Alvera Street, and I'm in the office of Alan Young, and he's very happy. He's just had three wonderful days, and Alan, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you, Walter, for inviting me.
You don't carry around props like this, do you?
No, I just found that under the table here. Somebody evidently left it on their way home.
Did you ever work with props much?
Oh, yes, in live television.
Tell me about your prop experiences, because I only used a prop once in my life, and it was such a disaster that I went away from it.
Well, I had a great time. They say when ignorance is bliss, or where ignorance is bliss. And so I was quite ignorant that they might not work. And I had a wonderful time for about 3 months with all the props working beautifully. And then one day, one didn't work too well, and I was shocked. But I kept at it. It's very difficult, isn't it?
You know, when I was a kid, and that's going back, brother, because I'm officially a member of the Gerithol set, I read about President Coolidge, and he was riding an electrical horse in the White House. And I remember the lyric. I wrote a song called President Coolidge, the newspapers say, rides an electrical horse every day in a gymnasium, morning and night. He rides for a mile in electrical light. Well, anyway, I wrote this ridiculous song, and I broke it in Bangor, Maine. And I think they were still voting for McKinley when I got there. They didn't know what I was doing. And when the horse was supposed to come off, it went that way, and I landed in the footlight trough, and it was a disaster, and I never had a prop in my hands in.
Yes, it's a challenge right away.
Well, Wynn, who was one of my patron saints, I mean, Ed Wynn came through South Bend when I was a student, and I interviewed him, and he worked so beautifully with props. I remember the that ridiculous prop of the typewriter. Remember the corn device?
Yes.
You've seen that, haven't you?
Oh, and the bicycle on the piano that he pedaled the piano around. Beautiful.
There was another thing on the bicycle and the piano that I liked. When he came to South Bend, and this was 21, when I interviewed him, in came three women, a trio, singers, and they were all matronly, Alan. And they handed Ed a little piece of paper on which was written, would you please give these girls a chance? And I remember Wynn looking at these three dames and saying, did you just get this? And it was a belly laugh. Now, why don't you tell these people what you just told me about why you've had such a happy 3 days? Because any mention of Benny Rubin is good news.
Well, we've been working on the show, and Benny Rubin is playing a part. And, of course, Benny goes back a long, long way, as you know. And Benny was just full of stories, reminiscing. We also had I would say, one of the ace card tricksters of California, if not perhaps in America, a J. Osey.
And wait a minute, is that like the French word Osey?
No, it's J-A-Y, and the last name is O-S-E. I guess you pronounce that Osey, mm-hmm. I don't know. But between Benny telling stories and Jay doing card tricks, I don't know whether I did all my lines right or not, and I couldn't care less. It was just lovely. You forget our business is so full of marvelous stories about marvelous people, fascinating people. Not the people who are now successful particularly, but mostly the people who missed it. And they missed it because they were just not as perhaps ambitious in a monetary sense, but they were just wonderful characters. Well, you know that, and you know the people, I'm sure.
Alan, I read a line yesterday that pierced me. It penetrated. It went way down deep into me, and I thought, boy, that embodies a lot of truth. The guy said, character is more important than talent.
Oh, yes.
And think of the people who think the reverse.
Yeah, yeah.
The business is loaded with people who think talent is more important than character, and they're ruthless, and they're merciless, and it's what makes Sammy run, and they step over the body because they're talented. They're geniuses, you know?
Yes. Well, talent can be stolen or adopted, where character has to be grown, homegrown.
Built in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps from the seed.
And, of course it's from the seed, and it's an unaware greatness. It's it isn't a labored greatness. It isn't the thing that a guy works at. It happens to him.
Yes, that's right.
I think that's it. Look, I'm visiting with Alan Young, ladies and gentlemen, star of the popular CBS series, Mr. Ed. This is Walter O'Keefe, and I've got to go out and feed the horse, and I'll be back with Alan in a little while. My guest is Alan Young, and my name is Walter O'Keefe, and we're in an office on his lot where he has very graciously received us, and we have been talking about very important things like happiness and integrity and things like that. I just had to ask, Alan, I became aware of him in the 40s, and I had to say, what year was it you did the Cantor substitution?
1945. I came to New York.
You never did. That's about the only substitution you did, wasn't it?
Yes, I was Eddie Cantor's summer replacement during that summer.
And he's a marvelous guy.
Oh,
Eddie.
Yes.
And I think of you saying substituted for Cantor. Alan, my problem all my life was trying to find out what I was supposed to be, and I was the great substitute. Let me give you a routine of them. You see, my feeling is, we know what a ham is. That's a good word in our business. And a ham is a guy who can look in the mirror day after day after day and never find any reason to quarrel with what he sees there.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me give you the point on this. I substituted for Winchell in 32. I substituted for Fred Allen in 37. I substituted for Edgar Bergen in 42. I substituted for Don McNeil in 47. I substituted for Milton Berle in 1950. I substituted for Herb Schreiner in 53 and 54. I substituted for Gary Moore in 1955. And there's not the only thing worse than an ordinary ham is a Catholic ham. And so I became into television, and I started to look around for a summer job, and I wondered what Bishop Sheen was doing. And that's the story of my life.
Very good.
Being a substitute. Well, tell me about you and Cantor. Did you do the summer show? Because this was a relaxed performance that I first caught you with.
I did the summer show, yes.
Did CBS pick you up after that?
No, the sponsor picked me up.
Uh-huh.
I came down, I never met Eddie Cantor until a year later. The sponsor brought me down to replace him for the summer. Eddie was in Hollywood and I was in New York. I did the summer show, and the end of the show, the sponsor said, we'll give you your own show on another network. It was then the Blue Network.
Oh, yeah.
So I went on a show on the Blue Network with the same sponsor and stayed in New York and then came out to Los Angeles in January of 46.
Well, now, I'd like to know, you know, ladies and gentlemen, when you're going to interview somebody and one of the stars, invariably his PR man, we used to say publicity agents, they don't say that anymore, they say PR now, public relations fella, gives you some biographical data, and I'd like to know what kind of a monologue Alan was doing when he was 13 years old.
Oh, dear, isn't that great?
Oh, I want to know, Alan. Come clean.
I will come clean.
This was in Canada?
This was in Canada. I substituted for my sister that night. It was for the Caledonian Society in Vancouver, British Columbia, and she had bought a recitation, as they used to know.
She bought one?
Bought a recitation with piano accompaniment called The Green Eye of the Little Yellow God. I think it was one of Stevenson's poems. And she said, I can't do this. It's just not right for me. I said, I'll do your show. So I went down. I didn't know what I was going to do because I was only 13, but I had heard Stanley Holloway giving Albert and the Lion a Lancashire recitation on the radio. And so I remembered it because I'd listened to it so much. And I got up and I did Albert and the Lion.
Give us a few lines of Albert and the Lion.
There's a famous seaside place called Blackpool that's noted for fresh air and fun. And Mr. and Mrs. Ramsbottom went there with young Albert, their son. A grand little lad with their Albert, all dressed in his best, quite as swell. He'd a stick with an horse's head handle, the finest that Woolworths could sell. And it goes on and on with Albert and the Lion.
Oh.
And so I did it, and it got a scream.
Sure.
What
did you wear? I'm curious about your clothes.
Well, I remember being English or Scottish, in Scottish-Canadian, it was my first pair of long pants because I can remember my legs shaking so much that my knee was hitting the front of the pants, the back of my leg was hitting the back of the pants, and the pants weren't moving. Just a fluttering going on in there.
Yeah.
So, but I remember getting an encore, and I didn't know what an encore was. And they said, "You want you to do some more," so I did the recitation again. And got bigger laughs the second time because of the idea.
This is Walter O'Keefe, and I'm in Alan Young's office. Alan, as you know, is the star of Mr. Ed, the popular CBS-TV comedy series. Alan and I will be back a little bit later.
This is Walter O'Keefe. The show is Almanac. My guest is Alan Young, who's standing by, and we're saluting the year 1947. I remember it very, very beautifully because my agents, the William Morris office, brought me out here to play two guest shots with the queen of comedy, Joan Davis. Remember, Joan? And Rudy Valley, an old friend of mine, heard I was here and asked me to go over to Vegas, and I made two appearances with Rudy. And I'll never forget the young actor who was hanging around Vegas with me, hoping that he'd make the grade, which, God, what he did. His name was Kirk Douglas. And this was all back in the year 1947. Well, anyway, the song that everybody was singing that year was from the Lerner Lowe Laboratory. It's Les Brown's orchestra doing it here, and the song has been a standard and a favorite and one you've loved ever since. Almost like being in love. Maybe you recognize that hit from 1947, that hit from Brigadoon, that hit from Lerner and Lowe called Almost Like Being in Love. This is Walter O'Keefe. The show is Almanac. We're saluting the year 1947. And our guest today is a very engaging and gracious young fella. His name is Alan Young. And we'll be back in a while. This is Walter O'Keefe. O'Keefe, ladies and gentlemen. It's still the show almanac. It's still Alan Young as our guest, and it's still the year 1947, which happened to be a big year in our business here in show business. I mean, let me give you the news for the women first. In 1947, Dior and the new look, that was the big deal. And, of course, 1947, Bing Crosby was making pictures here with Barry Fitzgerald. You know, there was a talent I loved, and I was brought out from the East on a deal there, and I met Barry Fitzgerald, and I wanted to have him do one thing. I would have loved to have seen Barry Fitzgerald, this little bit of a Crabtree-like man, this little shriveled guy, as a bartender, because I had studied bartenders in my spare moments, and if he had a towel in his hand standing at the bar, I wanted to have him have a theme song. In that little Irish voice of his, I wanted Barry Fitzgerald to sing this. Darling, je vous aime beaucoup, but I don't know what to do. I thought it would be very lovely. Anyway, we're going to come back with some music from 1947. Part of the magic of 1947 was a picture that was being made that year a block away from where we're broadcasting right now at Paramount Studios. And it was a Paramount picture, needless to say. It was produced by Danny Dare. And Jimmy Van Heusen and Johnny Burke did the music and lyrics. And Bing was in it, and Bob Hope was in it, and Dorothy L'Amour, and that eminent masker Frank Phelan, and Joe Vitale, all of these guys. Vic Young's orchestra did the job here. There was a trumpet solo by Manny Klein. And all of these guys I have enjoyed and been fond of and respected and admired, including Mr. Crosby, whose voice is caught here, doing But Beautiful.
Love is funny, or it's sad, or it's quiet, or it's mad. It's a good thing, or it's bad, but beautiful. Beautiful to take a chance, and if you fall, you fall, and I'm thinking I wouldn't mind at all. Love is tearful, or it's gay. It's a problem, or it's play. It's a heartache either way, but beautiful. And I'm thinking, if you were mine, I'd never let you go. And that would be but beautiful, I know.
By guess who? It was a Jimmy Van Heusen, Johnny Burke song, and the 1947 big hit, The Road to Rio. Vink Young's orchestra's in there. Manny Klein was the horn tutor. I'm sure that Perry Bodkin was on the strings. I'm sure Larry Binion was one of the horn tutors, too. And this brings back very pleasant memories. This was a very good year for these people. And this is a very good year for me because my guest is Alan Young, and he's coming back here in just a moment. This is Walter O'Keefe, and I'm in Alan Young's office, and I'm still overwhelmed by that feat of memory that the kid just pulled on me here. Alan, how long since you were... What was the name of that piece of pastrami you just did?
It's called Albert and the Lion.
Now, let me ask you this. Alec Templeton's pal, was it Pat O'Malley?
Pat O'Malley.
Yeah. I mean...
Well, this is long before then when who'd I just say? His record. He was in My Fair Lady.
Oh, Holloway.
Holloway, Stanley Holloway. Yeah. Recorded that. That was a long, long time ago, and that's when I memorized it. But I heard Pat O'Malley when he came to America for the first time, because I was living in Canada, and he did that then very well. Wonderful recitation.
Well, I played with, you know, in the war, let me see, in 42, a guy named Fisher decided to revive big-time Broadway. He had priorities going around the corner, so he decided to put on a show starring Gracie Fields and Billy Gaxon, and I was in it, and he called it Top Notchers. It wasn't. It was not Top Notchers. It folded very closely, but Gracie was a Lancashire girl, wasn't
yes,
she?
Yes, yeah.
Give me some more of the recitation. Now, this is a feat of memory, but we're... this is amazing to me that you can remember back this far.
Well, I loved it and did it. From then on, I did it everywhere I was invited. I did Albert and the Lion because that was my act.
Did you ever hear Maggie Dooley?
No.
I used to hear some guys at Notre Dame in the Glee Club when I was a kid. And they did a thing called Maggie Dooley, and suddenly I found myself in Honolulu. You've been over there.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, well, I hope you go. I want you to go there in Ojai. These are wonderful places.
I haven't even been to Ojai, and I'm dying to get up there.
You know Sheila Graham?
Yes.
Well, I came back from Europe after doing the camps in Europe, and Sheila was a friend of mine, and I was exhausted. I've been dragging my kid around Europe. I said, where can I go and hide and get some sun? And she says, try Ojai Valley. And I fell in love with the place. And that is one of the great places in the West Coast. And keep it quiet. Don't tell anybody.
I won't mention it to a soul because we want to keep it exclusive.
Did you know Ned Wolfe?
Yes.
Because the first night I was having dinner at the Ojai Valley Inn, and I was sitting there in solitary grandeur, and this guy came over, and in very gamey language, he says, if you squeal and tell any of those people in Hollywood how beautiful Ojai is, you're off my list.
Oh, that's lovely.
He's a nice guy.
I won't tell a soul.
But I remember when I got to Honolulu, and they put a ukulele in my hands. It was the Moana Hotel. And I sang, when Maggie Dooley played the hooly hooly, Ireland is fading away. Sure the Sweeneys and the Dailies have sold their shillelies and bought ukuleles to play. The fat Miss Kelly, she wiggled just like jelly when them grinders play. The girls go walking down the street all dressed up in shredded wheat. Since Maggie Dooley. And that's okay. From my teens, Alan. Tell me some more of those Lancashire things. They're
well,
wonderful.
I knew a lot of Scottish songs.
Scottish?
I hated Harry Lauder. Also.
Wait a minute, you what?
I imitated Harry Lauder.
My hand.
Oh, is that right?
I caught him at Albert Hall in London in 1912.
Oh, well, isn't
and
after
I put
that.
Myself through Notre Dame entertaining as
oh,
Harry Lauder.
Golly.
What did you do? Roman in the Glen
well,
or Reed Up and Doris?
Yes, I did that, and then there was some others. I can only remember a couple of verses. There's one, oh, Jock McGraw, you're a wonderful toreador. It's none of your skill, it's your wee bandy legs that tickle the bull to death.
Did you ever see him?
No, I had all his recordings, but I never saw him.
I saw him pull a stunt in Elkhart, Indiana. It was one of the greatest things I ever saw. I went from South Bend to Elkhart. Now, mind you, I saw him in London, 1912. 10 years later, I'm a newspaper man in South Bend, and I take a car 22 miles to Elkhart to catch him, and he came out, Alan, alone, solo, in front of the curtain, out in a full stage. And I'll bet you he held that stage 18 minutes, and he didn't say a word, and the audience shrieked. It was the song he had, I'm the Saftest of the Family.
The Saftest of the Family.
Yeah. I didn't know whether that meant the youngest or what it was, but he emptied out his pockets. It's the same sort of routine I've seen, I think, Edwin do. But the stuff that comes out of his pockets as a little boy, and the audience dying with that, and not a word, mind you.
Lovely.
Pantomimic stuff.
Yeah. Did he do the bit, dropping the match? Did he smoke a pipe?
Yes.
Well,
as a prop, yeah.
I remember seeing once as a little boy, the Scottish comedian coming out, and he stood with a pipe, and he took a match out of his pocket, and he dropped it somewhere on the stage. And he kept looking down at his feet, and he kept talking and looking down at his feet, looking for this match. And finally, he couldn't see it, so he reached in his pocket, and he took another match out, lit that match, and instead of lighting his pipe, he put the match down on the floor to look for the first match that he lost. Was that his? What a delightful
thing. I think that was his.
Oh,
yeah.
Just so subtle and beautiful.
This was the individual performance. He could hold a theater for hours, you know.
I mean,
this is long before the modern guys like Victor Borge did.
Yeah.
But I'd like to know some more of the steps up before you hit the big time, because I'm not even talking about America, but when you got out of that, those pair of pants you were talking about, my first suit that I can remember was a Lord Fauntleroy suit, may God forgive me.
Oh, is that true?
Remember Lord Fauntleroy suits?
Yes.
And
yes.
I sang, "Oh, you beautiful love," like that, you know, with a real high voice.
Yeah.
And I got $50 for a week.
Oh, boy.
And my father said afterwards, because my father had a long-standing feud with banks, he didn't believe in them. He believed in bars instead of banks. And my father, I'll never forget, here I am with a $50 bill, and I'm 12 years old, and he says, "You can have one present." And I bought a baseball suit, and he took the $44, and I'm still trying to find it all these years later.
It's nice to have relatives, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
They help you along the way. Sometimes.
Don't you think frequently that relatives are sort of a caricature of your own distinction and beauty and glory? Don't you look on relatives like that?
Yes, and they give you great ideas for monologues.
Give me some of the monologues that you grew up on. Or give me the ideas of them and some of the individual gags out of them. I always appreciate these things. I'm curious.
I'd have to think about that. It's so long since I have done monologues. I'll have to let's see. A lot of them were dialects, which is what I was brought down to
I suppose
before.
Everybody starts with dialects. I mean, I did 4, 5, or 6 dialects when I was a kid. I mean, this was a big deal, you know.
Well, I started with a dialect, but didn't know I was doing it. You know what I mean? It was me. And that's what fascinated or attracted the agent who brought me to America. And, of course, when I knew I was coming down, I would practice talking like this. I had a little routine I would do. The calf went down the path to take a bath. And I would practice. When I arrived in New York, I was talking what I thought was American very clearly. And he hated it.
That's
And he said, "Why don't you do the dialect you did?" So I'd slip into my dialect, and they wouldn't understand a word I was talking about. So now, whenever I'm asked to do a character, I'd like to do the character with a Scottish dialect or some sort of English dialect. It just seems natural.
Yeah, well, there are fashions. I mean, the Irish used to be great, and the Scotch were great, and the Jewish stories were one of the greatest Jewish stories storytellers I ever heard was an Irishman.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, Jimmy Hussey. Jimmy Hussey, I'm talking about a vaudeville headliner, he would stand at the Palace, and he'd kill New York, and he was a slender, tubercular Irishman from the West Side, and he was a sort of, well, he enjoyed as big a position at that time as Lou Holtz later took over.
My goodness, Jimmy Hussey,
he was great. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm visiting with Alan Young, the star of the popular CBS TV series, Mr. Ed. This is Walter O'Keefe, and I'm going to drop over to Ojai for a minute, and I'll be back with Alan in just a little while. This is Walter O'Keefe again. The show is Almanac. The guest is Alan Young, and we've been reminiscing about dialects. Alan Young was talking about dialects. Not my favorite dialect story, but it was a mispronunciation. I had a friend in New York, Mrs. Goldberg, Mrs. Lucia Goldberg. And one of the lines that she threw into my lap that I've treasured ever since was when Lucia said, "And the first thing you know, the girl is pregnant." And I like P-R-E-G-M-A-N-T. It's a nice word. When Alan was talking about the Scotch comedian coming to the States here, I remember an English comedian who, he came to play the Palace in New York when the Palace Vaudeville Theater was the temple of variety, and you played the Palladium in London, then you played the Palace here. And he came over and laid a very, very British egg. It was an awful disaster, and he was wandering around, and on 45th Street, there was a place called the Lobster Palace. The word palace attracted him, or whether he was hungry, but he was staring at the window, staring into the window where they had all of the merchandise from the joint laid out on the ice. And he stared for about 4 minutes at a bunch of fish that were just staring back at him with their icy eyes, and finally he says, "Oh, that reminds me, I have a matinee this afternoon." You know, in 1947, it was when television was experimenting, and I remember hanging around NBC and seeing the technicians busy with their technicking, because this is when you did live television. And I can remember the heroine, a very tasty, tempting, toothsome, trim, tiny, tantalizing tidbit, and she had to fight off the villain. So she got rid of this cad. She got him out of the way, and then went into her bedroom and put on her robe de nuit. That's nightgown to my son, if he should be listening. So she put on her robe de nuit, and she was supposed to crawl into the bed and go to sleep. And I'll say this for the girl. She was a very good quick sleeper. She'd been with the theater girl for a long while. So she crawled into her chaste little couch and went to sleep immediately. Well, the sound was awful because here's the live microphone. It's picking it up, and it sounded like nothing quite so much as the tugs down at San Pedro calling out to each other in the mating season, because she was saddled with what they call a deviated septum in her nose. There was a bone in there that didn't go right, so her breath didn't go right. And, well, to call a spade a spade, the dame snored. That's all there was to it. And it was terrible to see that they had a close-up on the screen, this beautiful girl, with this awful mess in the soundtrack. So the technicians, as I say, got busy, and they technicked, and they came up with a new gadget called the Snorer's Nasal Harmonica. Just a simple little gadget that you shove up the nostril of the snorer or the snoree before he or she takes off for the evening. And then when all that wind starts to rush down the open spaces, it harnesses all that power and plays How Are Things in Glockamora, which I think is leading us towards a song cue. And this is one that has been done by Mr. Welk. And the number that we have chosen here from 1947 is the big Disney hit of the time. And the big Disney hit of that year was also the Academy Award winner. It was written by Ali Rubel and Ray Gilbert. It's Zippity-Doo-Dah, and it's done by Lawrence Welk here. Sisters doing Zippity-Doo-Dah. And at the Father Peyton dinner last fall, Bill Gargan noticed the Lennon sisters, and he remarked at the dinner table, they look like three nuns on a layoff. I'll never get over that. Anyway, this is Walter O'Keefe. The show is Almanac. The year is 1947. My guest, Alan Young, will be with me when I come right back. This is Walter O'Keefe. Walter O'Keefe, ladies and gentlemen, the show is Almanac, and the year that we are exploring and having a few fond memories of was 1947. In this neighborhood around the movie studios, they were very worried that year. They were very worried because there were 10 writers who, I guess, were communist card carriers. They were affiliated with the Red Conspiracy, according to the testimony at the time, and so the movies were worried about that, and they were wondering where they were going to go, what was going to happen. They had two other things to worry about. Television was right around the corner, and Marlon Brando was only a couple of months away. I don't think the town or movies have been the same since Marlon Brando came here. So we will explore some of these things in the music, along with my guest, Alan Young, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Walter O'Keefe, and I'm in Alan Young's office, and I playfully made a reference to the lovely little town of Ohio a little while ago, and I found out Alan hadn't been there. And I just wanted to tell Alan one story about my trip there when I found it. I was back from Europe, Alan. I was awfully tired, and I love massage. And so I said, where can I get a massage? And they sent me up into the bush. And I found a guy up there. He was the highest compliment I could pay him was to say he was stupid. That's the highest thing I could say about him. And this is accurate, and I'm being charitable and kindly. Let's call a fact a fact. The guy was stupid. But I'll never forget, he wasn't a very good rubber. And he explained that he had been with the Dodgers originally, and this made him a character in my book. But he was now a bookmaker, and the Kefauver investigation had chased him out of town, and he was hiding in the bush. So he's rubbing me, and he started to talk about the manager of the Cleveland Indians. He says he's going to give me a job next year if I get my certificate. I says, what certificate is that? He says, well, I'm taking a course in how to massage from a correspondence school. He was rubbing me. So I have nothing but affection for Ojai. Well, now, I wanted to... you know, it's all very well. Everybody knows what's happened to you. Most people know what's happened to you when you've hit the big time here, but I'm so curious about those early years and the early experiences in performing. Did you do the banquet circuit as a teenager?
Yes, oh yes. Banquet circuit, and you couldn't make a living in Canada just doing that because the people...
They ate,
but it was all they could do to pay for the food, you know. And after the banquet, sir, always after a banquet, I would have to haggle with a fellow who booked me. He'd book me for $5. He'd say it was only worth $2.50.
No
I
kidding.
I said, wait a minute.
How old were you then? Teenager kid?
I was about 15 then. Mm-hmm. I'd say, but I promised the accompanist 75 cents, and if I only give me, you know, it didn't pay my ferry fare because I had to take a boat to get to Vancouver from where I lived. And so the haggling got me down. So I learned to yodel because... they had a lot of Western people around there, and they...
You mean you can yodel on purpose?
I
thought that was an affliction.
Whatever it was, I had to learn to do it.
No kidding.
And to sing these Western songs, then I could pick up a dollar or so a night doing this on the way somewhere else.
Well, how about school at this time?
I would do school during the daytime, yes, but at nights I would go out and do these...
What became
shows.
Of the sister that bought material, bought recitation?
I worked her into the act when I went into radio, and
really?
She played straight for me in some of the little routines we did.
What years were you doing radio up there?
Radio from 1935, right on from then on. Mm-hmm. When I finally finished school, the principal was so tickled, he said, I hope you're not going to go on to college. And I said, well... I don't know. He said, do yourself a favor. Don't. Because in study periods, I'd written all my material in study periods, and I just squeaked by high school. So he said, you stick to show business. And my father did, too. When he saw my first check, he said he'd worked very hard all his life. And he said,
what'd your father do?
Dad had been in England, a very, very nice job, and came to the New World. He'd been an executive in a shipyard, and he came to the New World and had to work his way up from mining right on up to shipyard, and the lowest job in the shipyard, right the way back up again to where he finally had ended up in Scotland. So he said, you stick with this talking business because lips don't sweat. And that...
Gee, what a wonderful line. Lips don't sweat.
And actually, it's the only part of your body that doesn't sweat. And I don't think Dad knew that. But I copyrighted that title, and then putting a little book together, which I'm doing, which perhaps in 40 years I'll print, it's going to be called Lips Don't Sweat.
Gee, that's a wonderful title.
It's lovely, isn't it?
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to George Burns. And, of course, George unquestionably carries great authority when he discusses comedy.
You betcha.
And he was talking about Benny, who is his favorite guy, as Benny is of millions. But George said an interesting thing to me about Benny. He says, Benny doesn't sweat. Benny never tries to be great. He doesn't have to try. He is great.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a quiet riot.
Yeah.
And I guess that's... I was thinking of that as I came over here today. I've never been conscious of you struggling, Alan. I mean, you've got a relaxed approach to you, and your technique. It isn't a pushing technique. I mean, it's no more like, say, a Milton Berle technique or a Jackie Gleason than the Man in the Moon, you know. Your approach is different.
Yeah. Well, one may struggle inside, but sometimes the struggle is not to let it show outside, too. I'm sure that Jack Benny finds that true, and I certainly do at times. But it's the approach that is natural to you.
Yeah. This is Walter O'Keefe with Alan Young, the star of Mr. Ed. That's the popular CBS TV comedy series, as you know, and Alan will be back a little later. You know, I want to talk, or rather, I don't want to talk. I want to hear Alan Young talk about Mr. Ed and the people with whom he's associated a little bit later, but for a couple of minutes, I want him to tell you something he was telling me about his father's work up in Canada, because it's a fantastic yarn, and I think you should tell the folks, Alan. Go ahead and tell us.
Well, we arrived, we sailed from Edinburgh.
Where did you settle in Canada?
We settled in near Vancouver, British Columbia. It was on the coast going up north, a little bit around the bend, sort of. But we had come out, we'd sailed from Edinburgh, and a family, not well-to-do, but very comfortable. And we arrived at a business that Dad thought he had in Canada, and it was somebody had gone west with the money, everything. So Dad had nothing. So we lived in a tent. It was wooden half. Wiped out at the start? Yeah, right away.
Oh,
boom.
Dear.
He was ahead of everybody. The Depression was 29, and he was 2 years ahead of it, you know. But it was one of these places, it was wood halfway up and a tent the rest of the way. So we were living there, and nothing, not a penny. So being a seafront, sort of, we had a lot of animals wash up on the beach. And from a sanitary standpoint, that wasn't good because people would come down fishing and so on. So the government would pay $5 a carcass for you to burn them up. And the Department of Sanitation, or Health, it was, gave Dad the job on this five-mile area of his beach to burn up any carcass that came in. And he said that you may find one a week. You pick up $5 a week, which isn't bad. So Dad took the job. Well, the first week, there were about 3 carcasses, which is $15. Very nice. Second week, $25. And so, for about a month, Dad was pulling down $25 to $30 a week, burning up these carcasses that suddenly had appeared from nowhere. And affluence came to our family. After about 6 weeks, the department came over very upset. They said, Mr. Young, you've been doing quite well here with all these animals. And Dad said, yes, there must be some sort of underwater epidemic because they're just flocking. There aren't one a week. There's one a day, practically. The man said, yes, I know that. But he said, it's very odd that the men on either side of you with their particular five-mile stretch to look out for haven't had a dead animal wash up in over a month.
Mm-hmm.
So Dad was quite surprised at that. Then they found that there was a young boy, a little boy, going out on a raft early in the morning, and he would paddle up and down, miles up and down the beach, and wherever there was a dead animal, he would put it on the raft or tow.
How old was the little boy?
Oh, he was about 7 then, I guess, 7 or 8. And he would drag them all over and deposit them on my dad's section of the beach so that my dad would get the money for burning them up. We later found out that the little boy was me. And I had helped my dad get into the burning business.
A sort of a shill for a marine forest lawn.
Absolutely.
That's a good title. I'll keep that.
A shill for a marine forest lawn? That's a darned... At 7 years you were doing that.
Dad lost his job, let's say, right after that.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Tell me, Alan, what were some of the... Did you have any other jobs? Was there ever any question that you were going to be an actor?
Oh, I didn't even when I was doing this. I was looking for something better all the time I was in school. Dad got me a job as a bookkeeper. He wrote the application out in sort of boyish handwriting. I would like to, because Dad being Scottish said, get near the money somehow. And that other business is no good. So he got me this job as an assistant bookkeeper, and I was accepted on my dad's letter, signed Angus Young.
You know, I think we all of us have been, especially we who have tried to make people laugh. We're funnier when we don't intend to be. I know. I went to the University of Notre Dame intending to study for the priesthood, and 3 weeks after I got there, I was a bartender, so that changed those plans.
Yes, it's there. It's going to be.
You know, I want to know some intimate things about... Everybody wants to be touted on a horse, and I want to get some dope from you, Alan, on the new life that's come to you through your association with Mr. Ed. What was the original... How did you first get sold on the idea of playing opposite a horse? I'm curious.
Well, Arthur Lubin was the one who started the whole thing. Arthur is the producer and director of
the show. We have interviewed Arthur. He's a very charming man, a very bright guy.
Yes, he is.
Well, will you tell us the story of the inception and the development?
Fine.
I'm visiting with Alan Young, star of the popular CBS TV series Mr. Ed. This is Walter O'Keefe. I'll be back with Alan in just a little while.
Musically, 1947 was a very big year. Francis Craig wrote and played this song first. Roger Williams, who was the all-time best-selling instrumentalist of the industry, is doing it here. And 1947 was a big year for Milton Berle. This is his theme song, Near You. Roger Williams. This is Walter O'Keefe's show, Almanac. We're talking about the year 1947, and my guest, Alan Young, and I will be back. ladies and gentlemen, the show is Almanac. The year is 1947, and my guest is Alan Young. And, you know, I can't look back and think of 1947, but think of the weatherman in New York City. And it was one of the loveliest forecasts in history. It was the last week in December, and the guy came out, and in the New York Times, this is what it said. It said, snow flurry. Do you remember that, any of you? Because it was the greatest snowfall in the history of New York City. They got 25.8 inches of snow, and it caused a lot of deaths and stranded commuters in the station. It was an awful mess, and the guy had started off with snow flurries. 1947 was a big year for Loretta Young. That was the year she won the award for the Farmer's Daughter. I was going to say the Academy's Daughter. We're the only sober people here. Ronald Coleman got it for Double Life. And you remember that delightful guy? Gee, a wonderful guy, and incidentally a good friend of my guest a week ago, Gloria Swanson's friend, Edmund Gwynn. Edmund got it that year, got the award, Best Supporting Actor for The Miracle of 34th Street, and Celeste Holm got it for Gentleman's Agreement. I repeat, Notre Dame were the football champions that year. I like to say that, you know, when you're a Notre Dame man, you like to remember the years of greatness. I'll never forget once when Rockne didn't go to Pittsburgh, and he sent Hunk Anderson down, and he went up to Chicago to pick $500 up for writing up the Navy Army-Navy game. And all of a sudden, Grant and Rice came over to him and informed him that at Pittsburgh, Notre Dame had lost 19 to nothing. He said, what are you going to do about it, Rock? Rock says, nothing. We'll just call Rome, call the Pope, and have it annulled. Well, anyway, 1947 was also the year when Yip Harbo wrote that wonderful song, How Are Things in Glacamora. A Streetcar Named Desire was the big thing. And we're going to have a song from 1947 in just a moment. And now the success story of Frank Sinatra. As you remember, he hit early in the 40s, and then late in the 40s, Frank was actually in trouble. Frank wasn't the hot property he later proved to be, but he had the staying power, he had the courage, he had the confidence, and he also had the talent. And Sinatra went up from here to eternity to the heavens, and he's Mr. Big today. But that year, 1947, he teamed up with Nelson Riddle in a lovely thing from Finian's Rainbow. Here is Sinatra singing Old Devil Moon.
I look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. The sky, it's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blazing their light can't hold a candle to your razzle dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm free as a dove, old devil moon deep in your eyes blinds me with love.
got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. Just when I think I'm free as a dove, old devil moon deep in your eyes blinds me with love.
You've been listening to America's fourth greatest industry, Frank Sinatra singing Old Devil Moon with Nelson Riddle's orchestra. This is Walter O'Keefe on the show Almanac, waiting for a visit with Alan Young. He and I will be right back.
You know, I think there is one question that everybody asks about a celebrity. They always say, well, what's he really like? And everybody enjoys that at some time or other when he gets up into top billing. And Alan Young has been talking about things that don't go into the ordinary interview, and that's what makes it very exciting to me. But the story of his learning a banjo through a window before he ever touched... Tell it yourself. Come on.
I just said to you that I learned to play a banjo without ever touching it.
Did you hear that? I learned to play a banjo without ever touching it. That's when I bobbled. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I used to... pass a secondhand store on the way to school each day, and my father used to play a concert banjo in the old country, and I'd always loved the sound of a banjo. And so I saw this beautiful old-fashioned tenor banjo, secondhand, dirty old thing, sitting in the window. To me, it was a star sitting there. So from somewhere, I got a book on how to play the banjo. And so each day on the way to school, I'd leave home about 10 minutes earlier, and I would go past this secondhand store, prop the book up on the window, store window, and I would pretend in pantomime to be fingering the banjo and study the notes and study the banjo in the window, and I would do 10 minutes a day.
May I say you must have been a kooky kid?
Well, I was going to be a comedian, you know that. So this went on for literally months. I was getting very good, but one day I came by, and there I went up to the window, and my banjo was gone. It was just a silhouette in the dust of where a banjo had been, and it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was heartbroken. All day long in school, I was no good for anything. That night, I came walking in the house, walked into the living room, and there, sitting in a chair, was my banjo.
Whose conspiracy?
Well, it seems Mr. Carley, who was the owner of the secondhand store, had seen this, as you say, nut kid standing out front, fingering nothing, had found out what my name was, I guess from the school principal, went to see my mother. He'd have to go to see her because we didn't have a phone. Told her the story, and my mother had been religiously every day saving her money and once a month putting 25 cents down on this banjo.
It's a lovely story, yeah.
You know, the ending is, once I got it, I didn't like it.
Yeah. Tell me about you and Mr. Red, because this is the big excitement now, and it's a big success, and everybody is happy for you.
Well, I'm happy for me, too, and I'm also happy for Mr. Ed. This was Arthur Lubin's idea. Arthur approached me 10 years ago about this talking horse. At that time, I was doing a review type of show, and I wasn't interested in talking to a horse or listening to one. Also, I don't think television was ready at that time for it. So when I got back from England about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Arthur said, I am still pushing this talking horse, and I think the time is ripe. So he showed me some film he'd shot on it. The idea of it, and I fell in love with it. It was so tastefully done and so sensibly done. You know, I think it was Chaplin who first said, or perhaps he copied somebody in saying it, if you're doing something funny, don't be funny while you're doing it, which is the greatest adage you can imagine in comedy. And so this was done so well. It was a talking horse, and that was that. So I said, I want to do this show. That's it.
And how long ago was that?
This was 1960, the spring of 60.
Yeah.
So the show was sold right away, and we did it. I didn't like horses. I didn't dislike them. I didn't like them. They had hard feet, and they were stepping on you, and their teeth, and they, you know, I didn't like that.
And they didn't run true to schedule when you bet on them.
Well, I had never been to a racetrack. I still haven't ever been, and so that part didn't bother me. I just didn't like them.
Well, hasn't Ed invited you over to meet his folks?
Oh, now, today I bought my own horse. I have a little horse called Edwina, which I ride, Miss Ed, we call her, and I am a horse lover.
Hey.
He's adorable.
Well, when did you first meet Larry Keating?
Oh, I met Larry Keating socially about 9 years ago, but officially and well, in the Mr. Ed show.
Boy, this is a talent, boy.
This is one of the nicest fellas to work with. We have a truly, every show says we have a happy family. I hope they're all as happy as ours.
And was this when you met Connie Hines?
Yes, Connie Hines. I had never met her before. I'd never met Edna Skinner. Arthur was the only one I knew on the whole show.
I think that's very encouraging to realize that a guy had an idea which a lot of wise guys said was way out. But nevertheless, he had faith in it and stuck with it. And your mind was flexible and elastic enough to stay with it.
Well, I had never talking. I knew that other animals talked because I'd heard them, but I didn't think horses did. So, because I'd worked with lions and all these other things. But the idea of a talking horse was a little too, as you say, far out for most people. But now they accept it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. You mentioned them. I'm sure this happened to you when you walked into Edgar Bergen's show and there was the dummy. You always said, hello, Charlie, or you started to, and then you corrected yourself.
Did you go to Madame Tussaud's Waxworks in London?
Oh, yes. I spoke to that fella.
I was going to say, my uncle bet me, I don't know whether it was a shilling's worth of coffee. He said, I was a kid, a little American kid, a Yank, and coming up Ludgate Circus. I'll never forget. Ludgate Hill. They had big roomy trousers in those days, plus fours they got to be known as later. And I remember a little Cockney kid seeing me walk along. He says, "Oh, Yank, have you got any lodgings in your bally bloomers?" Lodgings in your bally bloomers. But I can remember this. I can remember this sequence. Well, Alan, does the Ed thing give you any time for outside activities? Or is it going to absorb all your time for a while?
No, that's...
I'm just wondering about summers or things like that.
Oh.
Playing roles outside.
Yes. In fact, for the first time, I was able to do a musical. I'd always wanted to do a musical
Where'd
comedy.
You play it?
I played St. Paul, Minnesota. Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Hey, while I think of it, why don't you play the Flying Yorkshireman?
Oh, well, that would be lovely. Yeah.
Why don't you guys do it? This is one of the greatest pieces of comedy. I think it's one of the most exquisite. Cantor used to have the rights, I know, years ago.
Well, I'll try to find out, because we're looking for something for next spring. Because that, it gives me a lovely opportunity.
Why don't you do the flying Yorkshireman? It's made for you. Everything about you. I hadn't thought of that, Alan.
Well, I'll
But the guy came from your part of, of the British Isles.
Right.
He talked like you can talk. And you could... you remember the open... How long since you've read it?
Oh, dear. Since Canada?
I'll send it over to you.
Would you really?
I'll send it to you. I've got it at the house. I don't know, but I've got it at the house, and he goes down to see somebody like Amy Semple McPherson. She says, faith could move mountains. And he says, I suppose you could fly if you want. And the first thing you know, he's up in the chandelier,
right,
and his wife says, cut out that nonsense and come down from there.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, this would be great for you.
Well, we'll follow that up. Thank you.
I'm with the William Morris office. Alan, it's been delightful. And, hey, I'm going to push on this. I'll send you the copy. I've got one at the house.
I would appreciate it, Walter.
I'll send you the Flying Yorkshireman. This is Walter O'Keefe, ladies and gentlemen. My guest today has been the star of Mr. Ed on CBS TV and the forthcoming star of the Flying Yorkshireman.
All right.
Alan Young. My thanks, Alan, for making
this
visit so pleasant. I'll be right back. This is the time when I, Walter O'Keefe, on the show Almanac, look back at the year 1947, and I think to myself, gee, that was an important thing for me, because after playing with Joan Davis and Rudy Valley here, my agents, the William Morris Agency, called me and said, will you stop in New York, or stop in Chicago on your way home, and play the Breakfast Club? And I wasn't a guy who got up at those hours. I went to bed around that hour, but I didn't get up then, and they told me what the salary was, and I said, you interest me very much. It meant that I could spend some time at the pump room with Ernie Byfield. Mr. Byfield was the guy who delivered that wonderful line, I'm getting so old, I can't take yes for an answer. So anyway, I did the Don McNeil show 3 days. I went to a telephone and called my agents, and I said, if you can find me an ad-lib show like this one, a daytime show, coming from the West Coast on account of Anthony's asthma. My boy had asthma at the time. I said, I'll be tickled to death to sign, and within a few weeks they came up with a thing called Double or Nothing, and that represented the next 6 years of my life back here. Very exciting in 1947, because in October 14th, 1947, a girl went Hemingway on my program. We were over the whole CBS network, and this girl went very dirty in her language. And, of course, the shock, I recoiled from it. I thought, gee, this is going to finish my job. As a matter of fact,
We picked up 4 points in the rating, and Double or Nothing was airborne from then on. Anyway, we come to 1947, and you can't remember that year without remembering the wonderful song How Are Things in Glacamora. And How Are Things in Glacamora is beautifully done here by the Norman Luboff Choir, and it comes from the big hit of 1947, Finian's Rainbow. Let's have it. Which is really Pat O'Brien's theme song. The Norman Luboff Choir were doing it. And you've been listening to the Walter O'Keefe Show Almanac, wherein we remembered some songs from 1947, in the course of which we had a visit with Alan Young, the very gifted young comedian who stars in the CBS smash Mr. Ed, the horse opera. And you know, it wouldn't be an almanac if we didn't give you something to remember by, some wisdom, so let me do a commercial for the higher things here and mention this. When traffic moves more swiftly and smoothly, will people really gain time? They would if improved transportation meant more rest and leisure. But does it? Aren't people more rushed than ever? Don't they actually stuff more and more into the time they save by getting places faster? And when a man does have more leisure, what does he do with it? Does he really break away from the pressures of life? Or does he throw himself into more crowded pleasures? More exaggerated sports into reading, hearing, watching useless stuff. So the time you save turns out to be waste time. And there's only one thing left to do to look for peace and contentment. And peace and contentment comes not so much through doing what we like to do as learning to like what we have to do. Not through living where we like to live as by learning to like where we have to live. Not through having what we like to have as through learning to like what we actually do have. Not through working and living with those whom we like, but by learning to like those with whom we have to work and live. Something to think about. This is Walter O'Keefe. May I thank Bud Schultz, Walter Radke, and Cal Milner, who produced this job. I invite you to listen next week at this same time. This is Walter Keefe saying, live in my heart and pay no rent.